Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on Hammond student athletes returning to fall contact sports following an August cancellation due to the coronavirus pandemic. Samantha Horton reports Eli Lilly says its COVID-19 antibody drug is showing results in reducing hospitalizations from the virus. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. He offers tips to reduce pandemic panic while planning for retirement. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Student athletes filled the front rows of the Hammond School Board meeting Tuesday night, carrying signs reading hashtag let us play and give us a chance. The school city of Hammond listened. One day after the Lake Ridge School Board opted to resume fall contact sports at Calumet, the Hammond School Board followed suit by voting to reinstate fall contact sports at Clark, Gavitt, Hammond, and Morton. Fall contact sports were originally canceled August 4th due to the coronavirus pandemic, and a reinstatement was not on Tuesday's meeting agenda. However, school board member Lisa Miller brought a motion after multiple student athletes like Augustine Vargas Jr. pleaded their case as to why they should be allowed to play. Hammond's Celise Jones also attended Tuesday's meeting to potentially save his final prep campaign. The senior lineman gave a heartfelt speech at a previous meeting when fall contact sports were initially canceled, and he even cried because of the disappointment. Tuesday's turn of events had him smiling from ear to ear. Board Secretary Manny Candelaria and President Anna Mamala, the only two other board members in attendance at the Tuesday night meeting, put their support behind Miller's motion. Since the initial cancellation, August 4th, have had three of their top players transfer to Miraville to close out their prep careers. All three seniors have appeared in games for the Pirates, who are 4-0. Now that Clark, Gavitt, Hammond, and Morton are back in action, Whiting is the only region school left that has canceled its football season. The school city of Whiting pulled the plug on fall sports August 10th.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Battered Gary Lou Wallace High School, closed since 2014 and vandalized repeatedly, will likely be demolished next year. Recently, the school was the backdrop for a raunchy YouTube video that depicted young men running naked through the school, lighting fireworks, and using a stun gun on each other. According to the video, they entered the school with backpacks, intending to spend 24 hours inside. The Post Tribune reports school officials maintain shuttered schools have security, but the young men said in their video they spent 17 hours inside the school without disruption before departing. Despite security, many of the schools have broken windows or doors, offering easy entry, and grounds are littered with debris and weeds. Gary police are investigating the incident, and Commander Jack Hamady said they were working to file charges. Eric Parrish, an official with MGT Consulting, which manages the Gary Community School Corp, told the Distressed Unit Appeal Board that Lou Wallace attracts the most 911 calls. He said about $1 million in a school improvement fund made possible through the deferred state loan funds will be used for the demolition. School officials also provided an update on the sale of other vacant schools. Lead manager Paige McNulty said sold signs will be going up soon on 20 buildings. Specific schools being sold were not identified.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Indianapolis-based Eli Lilly says its COVID-19 antibody drug is showing results in reducing hospitalizations from the virus. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, this is the company's first data to be reported on mild to moderate cases, but still needs to be reviewed by peers.
The data comes from the trial's Phase 2 patients who had recently tested positive for COVID-19 before participating in the study. The group saw about 75% fewer hospitalizations from people who received the antibody treatment compared to those who received the placebo. The initial data only includes several hundred people, but Lilly Vice President Andrew Adams says results show strong findings that he and others will continue to research.
Those are really small numbers right now, and it is a small study, but we believe that this could be a turning point for research in mild to moderate COVID-19, and we're hoping that this will continue to bear out in additional ongoing studies we have.
Adams says Lilly is working to get the antibody treatment more widely available to patients, especially in emergency settings. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana U.S. Senator Mike Braun says he'll be disappointed if the federal government provides any financial support for state and local government budgets in future COVID-19 relief packages. State budget officials project Indiana will have a $1 billion hole in its budget by the end of the current fiscal year, even with the state's significant financial reserves. They've repeatedly asked for federal help, including by loosening restrictions on existing Federal CARES Act funding. That's in part why the state still hasn't spent more than half of the money, although that's not what Braun thinks.
I think we're sitting on all the money that was given to us by the federal government because we have not had to use it.
Asked directly why Braun doesn't support the kind of help Governor Eric Holcomb and state officials have requested, he said this.
We will make it through it based upon how we've lived our life in a responsible way as a state government.
The governor has already cut higher education funding and asked state agencies to slash their budgets by 15%.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A senior Indiana budget official says the state is somewhat paralyzed by conflicting directives from the federal government over how it can spend COVID relief dollars. The Trump administration continually sends guidance to the states over how they can spend federal CARES Act funding, but that can often confuse more than it helps. State Office of Management and Budget Director Chris Johnson says, for example, the U.S. Treasury sent updated guidance at the end of August. The Treasury's Inspector General also sent guidance a few days later that didn't match.
Fear the Inspector General that comes out to your state and says, give me all your documentation of why you made this decision, has sort of put a little paralysis out there in people's minds.
The state has earmarked less than half of the $2.4 billion it's received in CARES Act funding, and it's actually spent less than 10% of the total. Democratic Representative Greg Porter says, conflicting guidance or not, the federal government requires CARES Act money to be spent by the end of December.
I'm just trying to figure out how much money we're going to have left, how much money we might potentially have to revert back to the federal government.
Johnston says he's hoping for clearer guidance soon.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Supreme Court Justice Loretta Rush has tested positive for COVID-19, her office announced Monday. Rush is the highest-ranking state official who's publicly announced a positive COVID test. Rush's office said she took a test after a family member was positive and was already self-isolating before her own results came in. The Chief Justice was previously working remotely and hasn't been to the State House since September 1st.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill would rather a court eliminate the current vote-by-mail option for Hoosiers age 65 or older than allow every eligible voter to cast a mail-in ballot. That's from an ongoing lawsuit aimed at expanding vote-by-mail for the fall election. The people suing to expand Indiana's vote-by-mail argue that the 26th Amendment, which sets the voting age at 18, means the state can't limit mail-in voting by age. Attorney General Curtis Hill disagrees, but added in a legal brief that if a court went along with that notion, he'd rather it invalidated the option for those 65 or older. Democratic AG candidate Jonathan Weisenfeld calls Hill's position, quote, short-sighted, purely political, and dangerous. Republican candidate Todd Rokita says he hasn't read Hill's brief, but he doesn't want to see any changes to Indiana's election system this close to Election Day.
We don't have the infrastructure. We don't have the facilities. We don't have the person power to conduct a mail election accurately without fraud.
Indiana expanded vote by mail to all voters who wanted it for the 2020 primary. Republicans have blocked all efforts to do so for the general election.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Black and Latinx people have been hit much harder by COVID-19. These are also communities with a history of mistrust of government. As SideEffects Public Media's Lauren Bavis reports, that could make contact tracing, a critical part of controlling the spread of the virus, more difficult.
At a late August news conference, Indiana State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box said it's crucial for Hoosiers to participate in contact tracing.
So if you get a text or a phone call from the State Department of Health about an important public health matter, please answer the text, answer the call.
But some community health leaders say for many, answering that call is easier said than done. That's especially true for those more at risk of contracting the virus.
Because contact tracing, taken out of context, is I'm being traced, I'm being tracked, especially when we, in racial and ethnic minority communities and Hispanic and Latino communities, that's a real concern.
Tony Gillespie is with the Indiana Minority Health Coalition. Since the pandemic started, groups in the coalition have discussed the importance of locally led testing and contact tracing efforts.
That's community-based activity, and so you can't really do community-based activity without community.
Yet Gillespie says the state did not seek input from community health groups before it developed a contact tracing plan. And that's happened across the country. Amanda Merck is with Salud America, a national organization that works to raise awareness of Latinx health issues. She says as states built up their contact tracing workforce, they didn't always seek tracers from marginalized communities.
A lot of the concern is there's problems when the public health workforce doesn't reflect the communities it's intended to serve.
In April, Indiana hired a Virginia-based company, Maximus, to develop a call center. It now has 680 contact tracers. After a person tests positive for COVID-19, contact tracers try to reach them by text and then with a phone call. Margarita Hart heads Esperanza Ministries, a nonprofit that works with undocumented immigrants. She says her clients would not answer a call or text from an unknown number.
It doesn't work the way that it's set up. And I'm not saying that it's set up wrong. I'm just saying that it's just not culturally appropriate.
The state says it's working to better publicize the number a contact tracer's text and call will come from. The state also says the contact tracing center uses translators for Hoosiers who don't speak English. But in practice, community health workers like Hart say if the person who answers the phone doesn't speak English, the contact tracer asks to speak to someone who does. Most often, that's a child.
They have to then get their third grader, fourth grader, to interpret because that's the only person at home.
Even if the contact tracer speaks Spanish, that's not enough for Gabriela Lemos's clients. She's the Latino community health worker for Health Visions Midwest in Fort Wayne.
They know the language, but they don't know your culture.
Lemos says her clients don't always tell contact tracers who they were with or what large gatherings they've attended. They may be embarrassed about ignoring public health guidelines. And though the state says contact tracers don't ask about immigration status, Lema says her clients want to protect their family, friends, and neighbors, some of whom may be undocumented.
So they're not giving the true information, and they're not giving the correct information to those people to get their tracing right.
Contact tracers tell those who test positive to stay home for the CDC-recommended 14 days. But Lema says her clients in that situation have questions and need resources, and they don't feel comfortable asking a stranger for help, even if that stranger speaks Spanish.
And they will tell or share more information with a trusted person that they know in the community.
In August, the state reported more than 76% of people reached by a contact tracer completed an interview. Most states don't publicly report data on contact tracing, so it's hard to know how Indiana compares to the rest of the Midwest or the nation. Meanwhile, Indiana's contact tracing workforce is growing. Including contact tracers at local health departments, there are more than 1,200 statewide. But some researchers say thousands more are needed. According to George Washington University estimates, Indiana should have more than 5,500 contact tracers. Lauren Bavis, Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with the Northwest Indiana financial advisor, Greg Hammer.
Well, planning for retirement in the midst of a global pandemic is probably creating some panic in many Americans these days. But there are some good things that you should know about, in particular, to be able to stop this so-called pandemic, panic. And that's where we call on Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer to help us out. Greg, thanks for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, let's take a look at some of the things that one should do to try to keep emotions out of the equation, so to speak. First off, here about goals that probably are a good idea to set anyway.
Yeah, and I think it's more critical than ever to actually create an income plan if you're coming into or nearing retirement, as we call it, the red zone, and just identify the gaps, the risks that your particular plan might have, match them up with some of your goals, and you know, make sure you have the correct time horizons, things are matching your risk tolerance, and your overall distribution plan identifies solutions or has, you know, the actionable steps that you'll take already identified prior to any type of market correction.
Mm-hmm. I guess, and here again, I guess you have to start early, obviously. If you think about this early, then it is a lot easier to do, like you say, when you're getting up to the very end, about what kind of achievements that you want to make along the way financially.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you need to identify, you know, kind of what your need is, and not only now, like you mentioned, you know, as you're going through things, but also, you know, as you enter into or move towards, you know, your future and your retirement, what are the things that you're looking to accomplish, and really just to begin to look at what you're currently doing, see how well they match up, and make sure that you're on track.
I know it's very familiar to talk about market trends, and you mentioned that in the past that history does repeat itself, so the stock market is one of those repeats that can come up here. What should one know when you're going into this planning process and trying to avoid the panic that the pandemic can cause in being familiar with those market trends?
Well, I think the biggest thing, and you kind of hinted at it, Chris, is, you know, they're going to continue. Market cycles have been around forever since investing started. You know, you're going to have bull markets, you're going to have bear markets. I think currently, given our economic environment, it's probably even more difficult than ever to identify, you know, the direction of the market. Even, you know, myself, I look at it and it's kind of curious as to some of the things that occur and when they occur and how quickly they occur. But understanding that ebb and flow is going to exist, you rely on, you know, a disciplined approach, understanding that, you know, historically it repeats itself, you know, the old adage, what goes down comes up and vice versa, and just make sure that the approach you're taking is consistent with, again, your goals that we talked about, your risk tolerance, and understand that those market cycles are going to exist, and, you know, try not to let emotions grab too much of your decision process.
I guess, yeah, that's the way we can, so we don't get terribly excited one way or the other, I guess, if things change all of a sudden.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, for sure.
Another point I know that we probably need to think about, too, is We rely, of course, on financial advisors to try to keep a clear head about things. Of course, with 24/7 news coverage out there, and of course, there are dedicated networks that we are aware of course, that keep a very close eye almost to the moment of how the stock market is doing. Just should use these things as tools rather than my place to go to for every kind of advice, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's always good to stay informed. It's always good to continue to educate yourself, get information. News is a great resource, but you know, those news coverages, the networks, everything that happens, I mean, it changes so quickly, and that's, I think, one of the biggest challenges today is information is, you know, disseminated so quickly into, you know, the market and the volatility of it. You just want to be careful not to let the news drive your decisions, but make investment decisions based on, again, you know, what your overall strategy is, and take you know, and take the time to use those data points for maybe some of that future decision process. But understand that, again, the consistency of staying with what drives you, what your goals are, what your risk tolerance are, is the key.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about some of the ways to avoid or at least stop, if it has gotten that far, the pandemic panic when it's coming to a time for planning for retirement. We talk about, of course, concerns that you want to be informed about things, but I guess there is a fear of missing out on something. And what should we know about that and try not to avoid that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the fear of missing out, we always, you know, people, when they talk about their personal experiences, I think it's just really understand that you need to ditch the herd mentality. Just mm-hmm. because somebody else is doing it doesn't necessarily mean or dictate that you should take your approach that same path, because, you know, their situation, you know, should be and is, you know, usually different than what you're trying to do. You know, so as you get individuals or groups that, you know, are doing things, you know, emotions become just the reality for a lot of people with decision process. And generally, you know, that herd mentality exists when people don't have the guidance. They don't have somebody that they can converse with, somebody that they can chat with about what to do. They don't have a, you know, plan in place. They don't have things that, you know, will defend against some of the things that are ultimately their concerns. And often what happens is they act opposite of what they should and end up creating some, you know, long-term detrimental effects on their overall plan. Yeah. And it just makes it more difficult to be successful.
Is that what really happened, like early in the pandemic, back in March and April, where people heard about things and they decided to make some changes, but they maybe changed the wrong way?
Well, I think it was definitely part of it. You know, mm-hmm. for, you know, when you have something come out like this, I mean, as you know, we're in unprecedented times. I mean, this is something that I think the information is so difficult to interpret. I think a lot of that is just simply due to the fact that, you know, we don't know what is accurate information, especially when it comes to, you know, the virus. You know, what exactly is COVID-19? How is it really affecting us? What's the long-term ramifications on business? And, you know, so it makes it very, it's just, we're all stepping into uncharted waters.
Mm-hmm. I know there's one point that may probably we should spend a little more time talking about than some of the other points in trying to avoid this pandemic panic, but it's basically comes down to three words: diversify your portfolio. Tell us about that.
Yes, and I think, you know, people need to understand that diversity comes in a lot of different ways, right? As we're investing, how we invest in the market, there's absolutely a value in diversifying your portfolio in a mix of assets that are not similar, you know, introducing different asset classes like, you know, stocks, bonds, you know, real estate, that type of thing. But I think it's also important to understand that there are different types of investments, things that are very correlated to what the market does. So as you see markets go up and down, you're going to see that type of trend in those holdings. But there are also things that you can do that are uncorrelated or things that aren't affected by the markets at all. So diversification of your portfolio should actually include things that are going to react differently to different types of economic response or market response to some of the things that go on. And ultimately, you know, again, those time horizons are always going to be a good compass. You know, time horizons should dictate the type of volatility that your portfolio is subject to. If we're 100% correlated to the market, we're going to experience a lot of volatility, but if we're on a time horizon that's long enough, we can weather those storms. If we're on shorter time horizons, we're nearing retirement, it's just more critical, again, to create that preservation part of your portfolio that you can draw from and utilize when the income distribution need occurs to avoid, you know, distributing from things that are down, you know, in that particular time frame that you might want money.
Is it that difficult to be able to diversify a portfolio?
Well, and diversification, again, comes in a lot of different areas, and I don't think it's that difficult. I think, again, people hear about diversification, and if you asked, in my opinion, 10 people what it means, you probably would get 10 different answers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it goes back to the education process, you know, understanding, you know, what are the different ways that I can diversify? How can I go just outside the norm of the diversity definition in terms of, okay, have a mix of equities versus bonds? What are some of the other things that I can introduce that would hopefully offset a downturn in the money, or things that would provide a distribution more stable for a time horizon? And that's really where the income plan again comes into play, positioning assets for purpose, understanding where to take from what type of account, when, you know, should I take from taxable, should I take from tax-free, should I take from, you know, the brokerage after-tax accounts, and where should the volatility exist, where should I have my growth, and how should that all fit into the dynamics of what my overall plan is.
Well, Greg, thanks for the advice today, and we'll be back again soon to talk. That's Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.